Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Life is full of what-ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
What do you mean evacuate the building? Like walk out into the street and get hit directly by the nuclear explosion? That's a terrible idea. It just showed that they were completely thoughtless in their attempt to adapt to a nuclear missile threat.
You're listening to War College, a weekly podcast that brings you the stories from behind the front lines. Here are your hosts.
Hello and welcome to War College. I am your host, Matthew Galt. It's the end of the world as we know it, and I feel fine. It's fine. I'm fine. Stop asking. Between the climate apocalypse, tensions in the Middle East, the dissolution of decades-old nuclear treaties, artificial intelligence, 3D-printed weapons of mass destruction, immortal humans, CRISPR, and drone swarms, it feels like we're closer to a science fiction apocalypse every day. These days, it's not a question of when the end of human civilization comes, but how. Mike Pearl has spent years obsessing over the day it finally happens. That's the title of his new book, which studies the various methods by which humanity could achieve mass extinction. Pearl is a journalist whose work has appeared in Vice, The Outline, The All, and The Hollywood Reporter. Mike, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Matthew. It's great to be here.
Mike, why are you trying to scare everybody?
I'm not. I started writing about the things that scare me a few years ago, and the way that I like to describe what I do is I used to be terribly afraid of pit bulls, and I investigated how scared a person should generally be of pit bulls in an article called "How Scared Should I Be of Pit Bulls" for Vice. And I discovered that a pit bull is more likely than any other. First of all, I discovered that pit bulls are a consumer category, not a breed. And second of all, I discovered that dogs described as pit bulls are very likely to attack something, maybe another dog, but that no dog is especially capable of killing a person reliably. You can kind of fight off a dog if you're an able-bodied adult. If you're enfeebled and elderly, a dog might kill you. But if you are able-bodied and healthy, you can probably get the dog to stop biting you, or get the dog, you know, the dog will do that sort of like latch onto your arm thing. And then somebody will have to pry its jaws, but it won't kill you. And so discovering that dogs probably won't and can't kill you was a revelation for me. It sort of reframed my fear of dogs and made it so that if a pit bull seems friendly, I'll happily pet it. And that kind of encapsulates what I was trying to do with this book. Like, you know, open your eyes as wide as possible to what is scary about these topics, but not, you know, go out of my way to scare you and deal with the things about these things that maybe aren't scary, or in some cases can be kind of hopeful. So yeah, I'm not trying to scare people. I'm just trying to get people to look at these things clearly.
It's trying to banish fear, in fact.
Yeah. You could say that.
Okay. Well, one of the things I really love about the book is its structure. Can you explain to the audience, like, what the structure of the book is? I think that's really fascinating.
So it's generally structured. The chapters go from, nobody's asked this question before, by the way, so thank you. The chapters go, there are 19 chapters, and they go generally from the least grim possibilities at the start of the book to the most grim possibilities toward the end of the book. Well, you know, with a few sort of exceptions mixed through, but that's the general structural trend of how it's written. So it'll get more and more grim as you go until the epilogue, which is about the end of all existence. The individual chapters are structured such that there's a little bit of fiction to start you off, to kind of like whet your appetite, to get you thinking. And then the reported part kind of defends the piece of fiction that I wrote. Usually defends the piece of fiction that I wrote. I don't generally write a little piece of fiction and then refute it. Say, oh, but that's not really what would happen. Sometimes what I report out is going to kind of, in some ways, you know, imply that what you just read in the fiction section isn't especially likely to take place. But, you know, when I write that little piece of fiction, I'm trying to get you to think about the way I want you to frame it. So, you know, speaking of ones that aren't apocalypses, there's a chapter on the day that the last human-driven car rolls off the lot. And to get you thinking the way that I'm thinking about this topic, my little piece of fiction, I took you to India, so that you would stop thinking about how that's going to work in, like, Manhattan and start thinking about how that's going to work in, like, Mumbai.
All right. On that note, I want to point out that you've got, you know, you run the gamut here. We've got, you know, your last fish in the ocean, billionaires taking over the world, which I'll point out is number two. The last entry in the book before the epilogue is the day the last cemetery runs out of space. Why is that the most grim?
Because it's about cemeteries. There's spooky skeletons and corpses and coffins, and that's why.
Okay, fair enough.
Because it is literally about your death, dear reader. It is about, like, the fact that if, for instance, you're a veteran right now, if you served in Afghanistan last year, you're probably not going to be able to be buried in Arlington, no matter how. No matter what kind of bravery you served with, it's going to be full. That's not going to be available to you. There's a pretty good chance you're not going to be able to be buried anywhere. They're not going to have that available. Although I don't think the last cemetery is going to run out of space inside of your lifetime, but it's changing. It is dramatically changing.
This also speaks to another thing that I think is very interesting about the book is, like, obviously nukes and the internet shutting down, the really, like, frightening world-ending events are in here, but there's also a lot of apocalypses and Armageddons in the sense of great civilizational change, right? Not just the end of the world, but the beginning of something else new. Can you talk about that?
Most interviewers do not pick up on this theme of the book. Yeah, exactly. Yes, that is really what I was going for. Yeah, the best example of that is the first chapter, which is on the monarchy being abolished in the UK, which is something that the people that I spoke to at Oxford said was eventually going to happen, that the UK will abolish its monarchy. And if you look through the existing scholarship on this, nobody wants to think about it. Nobody wants to contemplate it. So, you know, I went to constitutional scholars and I said, like, what happens to your country if you do away with the monarchy? And they were like, glad somebody's finally asking this. So, you know, like, these things may not be, it may not be the end of the world. Losing the monarchy is the end of the world if you, like, work in British tourism, then it's kind of the apocalypse for you. But for most people, it's not. It's just a kind of paradigm shift that people don't think about in any kind of detail. Or if they do think about it, then they're like somebody from the Tory party, and they're like, oh, if we do that, it could lead to the end of monarchy. Or, oh, that kind of thinking could lead us toward a republic. And what they mean is they could lead us toward something unthinkable. They're not thinking all the way to a republic. They're just using the republic as an example of something unthinkable that they really, really don't want to happen. So what I like to ask is, well, okay, but what then? You know, what happens then?
Okay, so this book is kind of born out of this series of articles, a column you had at Vice for a long time about the future and kind of like how worried should I be or how scared should I be, I believe is the name of it, right?
Yeah, it's born out of that one, and it's born out of one called Hours and Minutes, which is usually about war scenarios.
Okay, so it strikes me as we're talking about this that I think probably when I was a teenager, that there in like into my early 20s, there's kind of what I'll call non-pejoratively a juvenile obsession with like the end of the world and end of the world scenarios. But then as you study it, do you feel like you kind of, as you learned more, you kind of grew out of it and became more interested in the greater question of what comes after? Because this stuff, we don't end, right? Like even with climate devastation, there's still going to be something afterwards. What the shape of that is up to us to shape, but there's still a future, correct?
Yeah, I mean, I think so when we talk about the apocalypse, we don't really define our terms. If you're Catholic, then the apocalypse means the final judgment. It means the end. And, you know, and there's a process built into that. There's, you know, their souls go to heaven. People are sorted out. It's not like there's just a period at the end of the sentence of existence and then there's no more, but it means a sort of theological end. I think to a lot of people, the apocalypse means, human extinction, which I don't think a lot of people think about. And, you know, I think, you know, there are a lot of people who, they think about the climate apocalypse in a sense of like, oh, you know, can I swear on this, by the way? Is this a swearing podcast?
Yeah, absolutely. Go to 10.
Okay. So, I mean, so a lot of people, you know, look at climate change, you know, you have Jonathan Franzen writing in The New Yorker, you know, oh, we're fucked. Let's stop pretending that we can do anything about climate change. And then there are people who take that a step further and say, we're all going to die. Let's go to the woods and learn to be in tune with like the dirt and soil and animals that live there as we contemplate finitude. And I don't think they're really thinking about, collapsed civilizations that currently exist. You know, there's this idea that the temperature will increase to a point where I guess they think we'll all kill each other for food. They have such a dim view of humanity that they think that once food supplies are cut off or once water is scarce, that we'll all slit each other's throats. And, you know, you can look at parts of Madagascar where that's very true right now. And things aren't great, but they're not all dead. And to say that humanity is going to go extinct in the near term is sort of weirdly naive. So today I just heard I was listening to the Current Affairs podcast, and I forget his name, the guy who works for Matt Brunig's think tank, who does Native American stuff. And he described the Native Americans as people who are familiar with what it's like to live after the end times. You know, this was all theirs. Pretty much the worst thing imaginable happened. And now they're kind of living with that, you know, they look through everything through that sort of scope of everything's viewed in retrospect. Everything's viewed sort of like through the lens of it all. This is all the cost of what they did to us, you know? And I think that our descendants will kind of view us the exact same way that settler colonialists are seen by the Native Americans, as these bastards who screwed you, and you just sort of like you live with what they did forever. But it doesn't mean you're dead. It just means things are a lot worse than they were.
It kind of feels like how Zoomers and Millennials view the baby boomer generation, right? But amplified.
Yeah. Obviously. Amplified, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
Okay. On that note, I want to transition to what I thought was one of the very interesting questions that you asked in the book, and I want to dive deep into this one. So, what's the likelihood that the U.S. is going to ban all firearms, and what would happen?
Great. So, the likelihood that the U.S. is going to ban firearms is pretty much nil. I use the Australian firearms ban as my model for banning all firearms, which essentially means not banning. So that's first of all. I couldn't get to the point where you ban all of, you can't ban all of something. You know, cocaine is not, all cocaine is not banned. And all methamphetamine is not banned. You can get both of those with a prescription. So if you go to Australia right now, where guns are, I'm using finger quotes, banned, there are still gun shops there. I went to one in Brisbane. It's just that they are a lot harder to get, and there's a large buyback program, and now there are a lot of regulations in the way of getting yourself a gun. So I used that as my model, and even that is extremely, extremely, extremely unlikely. I sort of took it as my premise of my chapter that some black swan event has happened and made banning guns politically popular. Because first of all, it's not going to happen unless it's politically popular. And that makes it really hard to write about because, you know, I'm getting on the phone with people from the ATF. I'm getting on the phone with people who are NRA members, who are, you know, part of what we call gun culture. And they're saying like, you know, what you're talking about is crazy. Taking away our guns, you know, nobody, if you do this, you don't realize just what this culture is and what we stand for. And this is our freedom and stuff like that. And, you know, and they're completely right. They're absolutely right that, like, I think most people don't appreciate just how fervent they are about the justification of gun ownership. So I sort of had to premise it on something having happened that has made the idea of banning guns popular, because otherwise it just doesn't compute. You kind of have to be living in a different America for a gun ban to even be in the air, because it's, I mean, it, you know, Marvel movies, you know, name a hobby, name a fandom, name something that people love. It just doesn't compare to how much people in this country love guns. It's like the number one hobby is like collecting them, buying ammo, going in the backyard and shooting them. It's what Americans love to do. And I think people on the coasts kind of don't appreciate just how much people love them. So that's first of all, not at all likely.
You kind of got into gun culture a little bit for this particular piece, right?
I bought a gun. Yeah.
What'd you buy?
I just bought a Ruger 10/22, just a 22 rifle, a squirrel shooter gun, because I just wanted to go to an Appleseed shooting thingy. You know those Appleseed shooting seminars?
I do, yeah.
Have you ever been to one?
No, I've never been to an Appleseed.
It's fun. You sure do shoot a lot of rounds. You bring a little mini stockpile of ammunition, and you shoot all day, and you lie prone and shoot, and you learn to like reload real fast and aim and shoot, and it's really great for beginners. But they also teach it to you on the premise that like the targets are redcoats and you're defending liberty. They're not like now you're going to shoot this deer or there's like a bear in the woods or something like that. It's not hunting. They are teaching you how to defend your homeland or whatever. It is about shooting people, preferably in the head. And it's like the most popular, beginner marksmanship course in the country. And it is all about, you know, killing people. That surprised me. And not only that, but it's all about sort of teaching you the value of the sacrifices of the Minutemen and stuff like that. You know, they really sort of like drill that into your head as the value of what you have in your hands is the gun that was, you know, assured to you by the Constitution. So, you know, all I mean to say is that this is kind of like step one for gun owners, for rank beginners. People take their kids to, or their teens to Appleseed to like introduce them to what it's like to have a gun. It is not some kind of hardcore militia indoctrination. And yet there is that tinge to it, you know? And the one that I went to was in Southern California. It wasn't in Tennessee. It is part and parcel of gun ownership that you are not going to let somebody, as the saying goes, come and take it, you know?
On that note, we're going to pause here for a break. You're listening to War College. We are on with Mike Pearl talking about his book, The Day It Finally Happens.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com. Life is full of what-ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
All right. Thank you for suffering through that, War College listeners. We are on with Mike Pearl. We are talking about The Day It Finally Happens. And he was just talking to us or just telling us about American gun culture and how we're probably not going to lose the guns in America. It's probably not going to happen because it would take much too drastic a cultural shift. And we just like our guns too much.
Yep. Yep. That's right. I write about the culture, but I do go through, how to sort of change the Constitution, how a ban would work, how the legislation would give way to buybacks, and one point that's very interesting is that most state constitutions have, extra little Second Amendment things written into the state constitution just in case they repeal the federal constitutional promise that you can own a gun. You'd have to not only repeal the Second Amendment, you'd have to repeal the Second Amendment and also invalidate all of those state constitutional amendments federally. Doing this would have to suddenly be very politically popular. There'd have to be gun buyback programs. You'd then have to really staff up the ATF, and you'd have to be ready to basically wage war.
It would probably lead to an armed insurgency of some kind.
I think there are a lot of gun activists who would criticize me for saying. For repeating that, because I think that's a sort of like right wing talking point that you can't ban the guns because they'll wage war. That's the kind of blackmail that keeps the status quo as it is. But to that I would say, I take them at their word, and they got the guns, and they like to use them. So if they are in fact blackmailing us, or if they are in fact threatening us with war if we try to take their guns, they can wage the war. I don't think necessarily that they would win it, but the conclusion that I come to is that the U.S. military apparatus is just the biggest thing in the world, and a lot of the people who own guns were part of that military apparatus and could put up a fight, but that's not to say that they would win. If you look at when the 3%ers show up to a protest to stand guard over the Proud Boys or whatever it is they like to do, a lot of them look very impressive. A lot of them have just come back from wars. They have their training is fresh in their minds. They're still in great shape. They could probably really do some damage. A lot of them, not so much. A lot of them, if they saw action, it was a long time ago, and they're probably not ready for for, you know, serious guerrilla warfare. So if there were a war between the United States it's a horrifying concept, but, you know, a war to take the guns, the great gun war, if it happened, I think a lot of people underestimate how much damage the gun fans could do, but the U.S. would probably prevail. The question is whether when people saw the news and when people saw the social media posts about this, about the drone strikes in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, would they say, oh yeah, keep taking the guns, this is good, I want the guns gone? Or would they say, stop dropping bombs on American soil? You know, that's the question. And so even if it were popular to know how people would dig in their heels and fight, would it stay popular as we tried to actually execute it? That's my question.
I have not as much faith in the U.S. military to win a prolonged insurgency against an enemy that knows it really well. But that's my take. And I also live and work in the South, so I've got a different perspective on things. But yeah, we could do a whole episode just about like what that kind of war would look like. I think what your point about people not being ready for things like drone strikes on high value targets on American soil, I think that would be, but now we're in like super speculation territory. So let's.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you're talking about, I mean, you say if it came to like guerrilla warfare between the actual U.S. military and people who know this area. I mean, the military is going to be a lot of people who know the area pretty well too. But you're talking about, I mean, what you're saying is that they're dug into the ground. They have in many cases set up with these battles in mind. They have set up their homes with these exact battles in mind, and they are really, really ready to wage them. And so the question becomes, because if you just go in with troops, a lot of these gun fans could probably fight them off. They really could. They have Tannerite bombs in their trees and tripwires, and I mean, they truly are, you know, military ready. So the question becomes, but the gun fans don't have bunker busters, and they don't have, you know, they don't have air to surface missiles, and they don't have A-10s. You know, there's a certain amount of stuff that the U.S. military has that is, you know, unquestionably superior to what the gun fans would have. And so the question just becomes whether they'd actually use that stuff, you know?
Well, it's been 18 years in Afghanistan and we're still using that stuff.
Right. Right. Well, I mean, yeah. So you're talking about that same kind of like police action versus full scale war sort of thing.
Yeah. I mean, I have a hard time imagining that it would be as intense as what we're doing in Afghanistan and have done in Afghanistan. And it would depend on like what escalation looks like and how many different forces you're actually fighting, because there's probably going to be many different desperate groups and not just kind of one unified thing. There's just a lot of weird stuff up in the air for what a new American civil war over a gun buyback would look like.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I mean, and that's the thing about the book, you know, is that you could look at my premises and come to different conclusions than I did, very easily, just depending on the kind of like the story that you tell of sort of how this is going to play out, you know?
Well, let's move on.
I think, sure.
Let's move on to a happier topic, and talk about nuclear war.
Great.
Your family was in Hawaii when the false alarm went off. Can you tell us?
That's right.
Can you tell us their story? Right. Like what happened?
So this is the false alarm. This is the Hawaiian missile false alarm, where everybody got a text message that said that a missile was inbound and that it wasn't a drill and that you needed to seek cover. So my parents were at a very large and well-known Hawaiian hotel that shall remain nameless, which had absolutely no plan of any kind for an inbound nuclear missile, which a lot of, you know, safety types, generally speaking, do not make plans with nuclear strikes in mind. And that was definitely the case here. They just sort of, it was this bizarre sort of flailing moment where people were running around the hotel, kind of guessing as to what the best places to be were. They decided on a stairwell, toward the middle of the building, and they were exactly right. They went to the bottom floor of the hotel. They found a stairwell that was toward the center. If it had been on the exterior side of the building, the stairwell, then that wouldn't have been such a great idea. But since it was toward the middle of the building, it was a really good place to be. But there was nobody there to tell them that. And there was nobody there who had thought this through. They went to the lobby. The lobby said, if the government tells us to evacuate, then we'll evacuate the building. And it's like, what do you mean evacuate the building? Like walk out into the street and get hit directly by the nuclear explosion? That's a terrible idea. It just showed that they were completely thoughtless in their attempt to adapt to a nuclear missile threat. And the thing about nuclear missiles is that they are, or the thing about nukes in general is that they are not the abrupt opening of a portal to hell. They are just very, very big bombs. And I think that's something that people don't appreciate kind of about what they are. I think when we talk about them, we talk about them as if one goes off anywhere ever, that's the end of the world. Which, you know, it's a good step in that direction, but it's not one nuclear missile going off is not the apocalypse.
Yeah, that's interesting. This is one of my wheelhouses, actually. And I think you're exactly right. And the more I've learned about nuclear weapons, nuclear preparedness, nuclear safety, I've actually been much less afraid of nukes in the past.
Me too. Yeah.
Because
me too.
Yeah. Because you talk to, like in your book, you talk to Brooke Budemeyer from the Liverpool lab, right? Who's this guy that does these amazing lectures on like what to do to prepare yourself. And like you watch those and you kind of get an idea of what you're dealing with. It's really like almost any other disaster with just a few key specifics, right? In terms of preparation.
Yeah. And in some ways it's more localized than a lot of disasters, I hate to say because the destruction is pretty widespread for a bomb, but it tends to be pretty local. Yeah.
Yeah. I was in, New York recently talking to the Office of Emergency Management there about nukes. And the gentleman I was talking to was like, what is the material difference between the advice we give for nukes versus any other disaster? It's generally the same, right? And it's just like what you just said, like get into the middle of a building. Or if you can get below ground into the basement, take shelter, wait a while for the dust to settle quite literally, and then figure out what's going on at that point.
Yeah. And not only that, but, my folks were convinced that if it were that it was a sort of like, that it was a strategic strike. They thought this through. They were like, well, the Pacific Fleet of the U.S. Navy is pretty much based, in Pearl Harbor, just right over there. They were on Oahu. They were in Honolulu. They easily could have been hit by a missile that was aimed at the Navy installation in Pearl Harbor. You know, it could have been Pearl Harbor too. And they figured that it probably was, and that they were doomed. And so I went to. I'm sure you've used Nuke Map.
Oh yes, Mr. Alex Wellerstein has been on the show before. So yeah, definitely.
Okay, great. Yeah. Yeah. So I went to Nuke Map right then, and cuz I'm a big fan. I went to Nuke Map while I was on the phone with my parents, and I was like, "Well, let me see." And then I brought up the actual megatonnage or the kilotonnage of the biggest North Korean nuclear weapon that had been tested so far. I dialed that into Nuke Map and I dropped it right on Hickam Field in Hawaii, saying like, okay, well, if they sent their biggest nuke and scored a bullseye right on Hickam Field And then I looked at where they were. They were in Waikiki. A nuke in Hickam Field leaves Waikiki pretty much untouched, and a large nuke that targets Hickam Field leaves Waikiki pretty untouched. And I think they were pretty surprised. But that's a nuclear bomb, you know. I thought it killed, you know, the entire city, and it's like, well, it kills a lot of people. It certainly doesn't spare a lot of the territory or in the immediate surroundings of its target. But, you know, a certain range out from a nuclear weapon, you're not going to be knocked down by the shockwave. You're probably not going to be hit by the immediate blast of radiation. There'll be fires. There'll obviously be the danger that comes from, you know, being near a horrible disaster that just happened. You're not going to be in a good situation, certainly, but the immediate effects of a nuclear strike will leave you alone. You know, where I'm sitting right now in the San Fernando Valley, if they dropped a Tsar Bomba, the biggest nuclear bomb ever dropped on downtown Los Angeles, where I am right now in the San Fernando Valley, I would be fine. So I think we kind of overestimate the size of these explosions. As big as they are, we kind of overestimate them. We turn them into something supernatural when they are just weapons.
Well, the other source of fear for these is that we don't normally conceive of them as just one. Right.
Yeah.
We're thinking about a massive launch.
For good reason. Yeah. For good reason. Yeah. And it makes sense to think of it that way, particularly since we haven't seen a lot of retaliation plans. We haven't actually, you know, those haven't been declassified. I'm not sure any of them have ever been declassified. The actual step by step plans for nuclear retaliation, for instance, if North Korea uses one of their new submarine fired missiles to bomb Los Angeles, then what do we retaliate with? Do we retaliate with 100 missiles? Do we retaliate with nuclear weapons at all? Do we use conventional warfare as our nuclear retaliation? There's something to be said for using our huge conventional military to retaliate, particularly since North Korea has been preparing itself for decades for nuclear retaliation. Going underground and building out huge tunnels, huge inhabitable tunnels that we don't even pick up on our satellite photographs. So, like, is it even a good idea to, you know, quote unquote, bomb them back to the Stone Age? We like to say that we love to use this phrase, wipe North Korea off the map. But if we used all of our nuclear weapons on North Korea, you know, we'd certainly do some damage, but could it be wiped on the map? It's not clear that it could be wiped off the map in the way that people think in their, like, genocidal nuclear fantasy. Would we necessarily retaliate with nukes? Yeah, probably, but not necessarily.
Well, you're also speaking to the limits of air power itself to win a conflict, but that's a whole other podcast.
Sure.
So, of all your doomsday scenarios, which do you still find the most frightening?
Which do I still find the most frightening? Probably the internet going down. I was shocked when I researched that. At just how helplessly we would be if we lost the internet, just how sudden of a change that would be. I'll put it to you this way: the reason that the loss of the internet scares me so much is that I thought I was going to kind of debunk it. And I came away from it more scared. I thought I'm on the coast. I work in media. Of course I'm helpless without the internet. I'll go find somebody who is going to be fine without the internet, and I'll talk to them. And so I found a long-haul trucker, and I was like, what would happen if you didn't have the internet? And he was like, I'd be fucked. I couldn't do anything. Nothing would work. I couldn't put gas in my truck. I couldn't get jobs. I'd be stranded at the side of the road if the internet went out. And I thought, like, and when you put it together, like, you can't use most point of sale systems in most retail establishments. They're all ISP based. You can't do anything. You can't make phone calls. An increasing number of, this was some original research that I did, but an increasing number of mobile phone carriers are using internet protocol based data transfer to move mobile phone ones and zeros around. When you make a call, that stuff is being moved from tower to tower with internet. They're not charging you for it as though it's internet. They're charging you for it as your phone minutes. But it's internet. Everything now is internet. Your landline calls are internet, and more the water that comes out of your pipes is backflows are prevented via internet enabled telemetry systems. And increasingly the people who work at utilities are not aware of how those systems worked before the internet based automation went into effect. That sort of institutional knowledge is gone. A lot of utilities could probably survive if the internet went down, but a lot couldn't. There'd be some accidents, definitely. So what I mean is that when it comes to global scale disasters, I think that there are some that we expect and are in a sense prepared for, because that we think that they'll like creep up, like climate change, flooding from climate change or something like that. Well, those are things that'll happen. You know, Miami will be destroyed over the course of decades. It's not something that'll happen all at once. But if the internet blinks off, I don't think we're ready for just how dramatic of a change that will be. How we will all lose this superpower that we've all grown accustomed to having. And none of us are ready to do anything, access our money, communicate with anyone, find information about anything without the internet. So that's something where the level of unexpected chaos that would ensue genuinely left me worried after I researched it.
All right, but how likely is something like that to occur?
Not all that likely, fortunately. What I discovered is that barring a deliberate attack, the internet is not likely to go down wholesale. An international subterranean data transfer cable, one of those fiber optic cables under the ocean, one of those could get severed by, you know, some kind of accident or by a shark biting it or something like that. Although they say they're shark proof now. So there are pieces of the internet that can get knocked out. There was this lady in Tbilisi, Georgia a few years ago who knocked out the internet to Armenia and most of Georgia by just chopping a cable with an axe. But the entire global internet, it would have to be a deliberate and pretty sophisticated attack, probably by a state actor, for that to actually happen. And barring global scale sabotage by a well-funded terrorist group or something like that, the internet is probably safe, just because it's so complicated and it's made of so many different things. So that's the good news.
You know, we usually like to end the show on a downbeat, but I think somehow it's appropriate for a book of this nature for the show to be a little different and end on a slightly upbeat note.
So, sure, I like it.
Mike Pearl, thank you so much for coming on the show. The book is The Day It Finally Happens, Alien Contact, Dinosaur Parks, Immortal Humans, and Other Plausible Phenomena.
Thanks. Great to be here.
All right. Thank you so much for listening, War College listeners. War College is me, Matthew Galt, and Kevin Nodell, who is about to go back to the Middle East. He'll be gone for about a month, and I will be flying solo, and I'm both mad that he is leaving me and worried about his safety. Kevin knows what he's doing, though. He will be safe and just fine, and we will get to hear all about what he saw and experienced as soon as he gets back. War College was created by myself and Jason Fields, who just entered an essay contest about how we can deal with Russia. His answer was, not much. If you like the show, please like and subscribe, share us on iTunes and all the other places that fine pods are casted. You can find us online at war_college and myself at MJ Galt and Kevin at KJK Nodell. We'll be back next week. Until then, stay safe.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.